Josh Cohen.
How are you, Matt?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm not bad. This is our first time on together, and it's nice to meet you here. I haven't met you on Facebook yet, Matt, where I sent you a friend invitation, but I'm not complaining.
I'm a late adopter to everything in technology, including Blogging Heads and Facebook and Twitter, which I just finally started in February. And I'm thinking about deprofessionalizing my Facebook and just going straight for, like, college pictures of me vomiting.
Yeah, it's how about recent pictures of you vomiting? We do have 40 friends in common, so.
Do we really?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
We run
in the same circles, or else whatever. Anyway, I'll maybe see you there. Maybe even though both of us, I guess, have been on Blogging Heads before, we haven't been on together, and maybe we should introduce ourselves. So I'll start. I'm Josh Cohen. I teach at Stanford in political science, philosophy, and law, and I am editor of Boston Review.
I am Matt Welch. I am a college dropout from UC Santa Barbara, and I edit Reason magazine, which can be found at greater bookstores near you and at reason.com. I live in Washington, D.C., regrettably, a longtime California resident, where you are now here in D.C. this week, at least, and maybe in the rest of the country as well. The big topic du jour and du semaine is Barack Obama's healthcare speech agitation and resulting popularity ratings plummeting. He seems to be sort of imperiled. I was wondering the outside the Beltway, more Palo Alto-ish take on what's happened to the healthcare debate and what it all means and what you hope for.
Yeah, well, I live in San Francisco, not Palo Alto, fortunately for me. In San Francisco, there are really three big topics this week, not health care, but the birther controversy, Sarah Palin's imminent departure, and the Gates affair. I'm kidding. Fortunately, those are not on our agenda today, three topics that people are getting pretty breathless about, and it's an unbelievable statement about the decrepit character of American political discourse that people are so preoccupied with them. So I'm with the Beltway gang on this one. I think call me, you know, extreme or whatever, but I think healthcare is a more important topic than Obama's birth certificate or even the dispute between Skip Gates and Sergeant Crowley. So two things. First, about Obama being in peril before we get to the healthcare issue itself. You know, Matt, if you go back and you look at where Ronald Reagan was and his popularity around this time in his administration, he basically slid from January 81 when he took office until about October or November 1982. He was really unpopular. This is not well remembered. And basically, there's a kind of political law of gravity here, which is when the economy is down, you slide politically. And, you know, I know a lot of Obama's supporters, and I certainly count myself as having been one. A lot of some of Obama's supporters may have thought that he repealed the political law of gravity, but not at all. You know, and so what I think on this is there's a lot of, you know, discuss, you use the term that he, you know, maybe he's in peril. I think if the economy is growing at about 3 to 4% in the first half of 2012, he will waltz in, and it won't matter what happened. It won't matter to his reelection what happened on healthcare any more than it mattered for Bill Clinton's reelection in 1996 that the healthcare reform stuff in 93-94 was a debacle. So I don't think, you know, I think the stuff about Obama being in peril on this is irrelevant, but I'm with Obama in thinking that the issue isn't him. I think that would be too bad. Another opportunity, say comparable to 93, if another opportunity were lost on healthcare, So I think we should put aside the Obama popularity issue. I don't think that's the...
Well, I think it's a factor only in that it plays a role in getting legislation done or not getting legislation done. I mean, I am kind of with you. I think that almost regardless of what happened, Obama's going to win in 2012. Americans like him, and they also like to like him. I don't really know what that means, but it's
I've always thought
he was pretty Reagan-esque in that manner.
Yeah.
I mean, people despised Reagan's policies, and I probably was one of them, even though
yeah.
I was 13. But they kind of liked to like him. There's something winning about his personality.
Yeah.
But I think that part of the reason why we've seen his poll numbers drop finally, where they come close to the unpopularity of his policies, because there's been a really huge gap between
yeah.
those two things. Like, yeah. you know, the bailouts have been really unpopular on yeah. at every step, but he's maintained his popularity. But I think that he squandered some of his credit with the American people, both during this debate and sort of more crucially before it. In the press conference that he gave on Thursday, which is a Wednesday night. It was a strangely mixed bag. I think that he's at a point right now where I think Americans are beginning to question his numbers. You know, people want to believe him when he says things like, you know, we're going to have pay as you go. I'm going to, you know, be fiscally responsible
mm-hmm.
and all of this. But at the same time, he uses what I've called, not necessarily a kind way, a kind of magical realism. I mean, this
mm-hmm.
whole formulation of
yeah.
we're going to create or save millions of jobs, which is how he led off that press conference,
yeah.
Which is a formulation which you can use to conclude anything you want. That's not the saleable way to say that this new plan is going to be sort of revenue neutral because we're going to bend cost curves and all this kind of stuff, especially when you have the Congressional Budget Office coming out with pretty different conclusions. I think, for me, I'm a person who thinks our healthcare system is a debacle on many levels, and I have suffered from it personally. I mean, I lacked health insurance for a really long time as a freelancer, switching between jobs, going through COBRA, various insecurities
right.
is a nightmare.
Right.
I think that he has, in his approach, which is basically to kind of buy off everybody on the table, add enough sweeteners so that he gets all the former critics on board. It's an interesting political choice, but I think that he is now trying to promise everything to everybody, and at the end, that's can't work, or
right.
he can't like pass the credibility test. I think
right.
he'd be better off focusing on the insecurity of healthcare. That's where people feel it. It's the X million people who are uninsured and people who are tied to their jobs and worried about healthcare as it is with their jobs. I mean,
yeah.
The sort of root, the original sin in the healthcare debate is the tying up healthcare with employment, which is a post-war artifact. And, you know, if I was Obama, and thank, you know, the world can breathe a sigh of relief that I'm not, I would start by decoupling that and saying, okay, you know what, let's make this something that individuals do, not something that, you know, you get without really shopping around depending on who you're working with.
Well, there are two ways of decoupling, of ending the employer-based system of decoupling employment from insurance. One is the kind of scheme that you just described, and the other is a single-payer plan. And I would say neither one of these is, though I happen to be more favorably disposed to a single-payer plan than to a scheme that doesn't exist anywhere and is entirely speculative, which is about, having... subsidies that enable everybody to buy their own. But that aside, I don't think either of those, is a likely trajectory. But I think this is an area where you have to, I come into this, it's obviously a very important issue, but I think there's, I've been kind of pessimistic that anything was going to happen on this, for three reasons. First of all, because there's a pretty unbroken record of failure in healthcare reform over the past 100 years. So you'd really have to be going against the past history. Secondly, it is an incredibly complicated issue. And you know, there are lots of hurdles to doing something on this, but part of them is the sheer complexity of reforming a kind of ramshackle system. And the third thing is that I think you do have a complete, for various reasons, a largely uncooperative Republican Party. There are also obviously big divisions within the Democratic Party on this now, but the uncooperativeness of Republicans, their, I think, basically desire to see this just as a defeat for Obama, completely politicized the issue, isn't helping very much. That said, the important thing is, to, as you started off, is to keep the, you know, keep the big picture in mind. You have a system that's massively expensive, more expensive than anybody else's healthcare system, that doesn't perform, that performs less well than other healthcare systems. And I'm thinking just of basic numbers on, you know, infant mortality and life expectancy. I mean, we can slice and dice as much as we want, but basically we've got a system that isn't performing particularly well comparatively, although it's more expensive than anybody else's system. It's killing the federal budget. It's killing companies. And this is all before we get to the problem that you mentioned, which is also at the core of this, which is that you have a huge uninsured population. You also have a big fairness issue here. I mean, basically, I don't know what you think about this, but I think that it's there's some unfairness when people have to bear individually the costs of how they fared in the genetic lottery. So the thing that we can't lose sight of on this issue as we're moving through the politics of it is that you've got, you know, the status quo is kind of a disaster. Now, it's true. Unfortunately, it's also true that there are lots of ways to make things worse. And, you know, I think, for example, the kind of mini-me public option that's on the table now is probably a way to make things worse. So there are a bunch of people who say there has to be a public option as part of a healthcare reform system, because they would like the public option, the current version of the public option, which is very small scale, to morph into something that's larger scale. So all there, but what's happened is on the politics of this is that having any kind of public option is drawing a bunch of opposition from people who are going to oppose it, whether it's big or small. And there's no reason to think that the public option that, that's been put on the table is, going to do any good. The other thing is that there, and I think we agree on this, is that there isn't yet in the reform proposals, these are very much works in progress, or I don't want, let me not be so tendentious, they're works in process. You know, whether they're works in progress, you know, getting better is another matter. But in the there isn't a plausible story about controlling costs. I think there's no, I don't think there's really that much disagreement about that. So there's now, you know, the, you know, what Peter Orszag has said is that the big game changer here is this MedPAC on steroids scheme for, you know, dealing with, you know, Medicare payment policy, the independent board to deal with Medicare payment policy. Paul Krugman wrote about this today. But, it's a work in process in that, you know, 2 weeks ago, that wasn't so prominent a piece of the reform effort. So what you have is a system that you're trying to reform something. It's fantastically important to reform it. It's an incredibly complicated problem. And there isn't really a kind of settled focus of the reform effort yet.
Yeah.
So that makes the politics of it really, that makes the politics of it really tough. That said, I mean, I watched Obama the other night and, you know, I didn't think he was absolutely, you know, completely on top of his game. But I had a lot, you know, I sort of thought, okay, here's a guy who understands the issues, understands the complexity of the issues, is trying to deal with this stuff. I thought there was some bullshit moments. I mean, when somebody says, you know, who's going to lose out on this, and you say nobody's going to lose anything, you know, I don't think anybody really quite believes that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the difficulties that he's having in dealing with this, I think, come with the territory of trying to do something that's ambitious, that's serious, that addresses a problem that we all think needs to be addressed, that addresses it in a way that doesn't make things worse, and that navigates a really complicated political terrain.
There's a bunch of stuff to get at. I'll just hit on a couple.
Yeah.
There is, you talked about sort of intransigent minority. I see a lot of commentary like that. People are talking about, how if only we didn't have the filibuster now, and related kind of commentary from the progressive left in D.C. at least. I think that is not necessarily the best tendency in the world. That's a way of putting it. I mean, if the policies put forth were genuinely popular, it wouldn't matter what Republicans thought. They would be peeling off to join it because they would want to seem like they're on the side of doing something that is popular and interesting. And I think Democrats have to remember, especially when you're embarking on such a major overhaul that could have just massive implications for the country, for the future. It could be sort of new entitlements. It could be new ways that we all sort of live. The burden of proof is on the people bringing the change. And that's frustrating, and I recognize that's frustrating as someone who occasionally, wants whatever change is being proposed in Washington. Yeah. But it really is truly on – the burden of proof is on those people.
I think that's – there are 2 points there. First of all, I think – well, 3 points. First of all, I don't think it's true that Republicans as an opposition party would jump on board a policy that was
– I wouldn't say jump. More like a few would peel off,
some people would peel off, and there are divisions on that side as well. But there are a bunch – this is a competitive party system, and you don't get political credit by supporting things that are initiated by your opponent. So that's a basic reality. I'm not making a criticism of anybody. That's the reality of competitive party politics. That said, second point, I do think that the core issue here is not opposition from insurance companies and intransigent Republicans, although those are important issues. I think the really big issue here, something I'm pretty sure we agree on, the really big issue here is this is an incredibly important and incredibly complicated problem in which when you get off the plane of abstractions that people like me as philosophers deal in, and you start talking about the details of reform, it's really tough to get things to work in a way that achieves these really two fundamental goals. One is that you extend insurance to people who don't now have it, ultimately to everybody. And the other is that you keep the costs of the system down. And you've got to do both of those. And you can't do one without doing the other. If you extend insurance and you don't worry about the cost curve, which is what the CBO has been worrying about, then you don't have an acceptable system. If you keep costs down and you don't extend insurance, then you have an even more monstrous system than you have now. So that's a very hard thing to do, and I think there's no
those
point.
Those two things are completely at tension with one another. Is one of the many kind of fundamental issues here.
You've got to do both. But the other thing is, in terms of the burden of proof, I think what you can't lose sight of, Matt, and it's easy to lose sight of when you think in terms of burden of proof for reform, is what you then defer to is a status quo that sucks.
Well,
so you got to beat the status quo. I agree with you on that. You don't want to make things worse. But
for me,
status quo sucks.
Immigration reform is an example of this. I was at the LA Times back and on the editorial page in 2006 first John McCain and then John Kyle and George Bush wanted to try to pass comprehensive immigration reform.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting time. I was writing the editorials, and our line there as an editorial board was, it all has to be comprehensive.
Yeah.
You can't do one thing at a time.
Right.
And, it's a big reform. It's very important. And for me personally, it got to a point where, every new addition to this comprehensive plan was introducing something that was awful. I mean, to the point where, every American was going to have to prove their own citizenship in order to keep and maintain their jobs, which is just fraught with incredible peril. And I personally got to a point of saying, hey, look, you know, the status quo is untenable on many levels. It's it's an embarrassment. It's a national disgrace. Yeah. But you're about to make it worse.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a a common sort of the cost of doing nothing is so terrible. But that's also a line that was used to help ram through the Patriot Act after September 11th. You know, we have to always keep both of those things in mind, let's say, right? I agree that the status quo is awful. I just think that the way to get after it is to introduce as much competition as possible instead of restriction. I mean, insurance companies should be banging down my door offering to give me insurance.
And listen, I'll tell you something, scam mortgage companies are banging down my door to refinance my house. And, frankly, maybe this is a psychological difference, personality difference here. I don't really want insurance companies banging down my door. I don't want them I don't want them calling my phone. Of course it's easy for me to say I've got attractive health insurance. I have an employer-based system. Universities are pretty good at it. But, introducing, there are two issues, about the strategy of dealing with the problem by introducing competition, which is, first of all, for a Hayekian like you, proposing comprehensive reform with incredibly unpredictable consequences you should be a little more cautious about that. Secondly, this is a program of reform where I don't think you can point to any model anyplace else in the world that works that way in a successful way. And third, just personally, as I say, I don't want insurance companies banging down my door or knocking at it.
I believe that competition is good. And I wanted to bring up one thing. It's easy to run down the many things that are awful about our health insurance system.
Yes.
But let's not forget that we also, maybe it's best to think of it as having two systems or three systems or something like that. At the level of people who are insured and getting stuff done, it can be on occasion the best system. We have great technology, great advancement, great surgeries, rapid response for various things that it takes other people to wait. I mean, it's a complicated picture, and for me, it strikes me as kind of self-evident that if you have less restrictions, the various state restrictions, for example, that prevent me from, as a Californian, from getting a Nevada company to insure me, if you introduce more competition, the more likely that those costs will come down. And then the separate question becomes, then what kind of, say, catastrophic public option do you keep out there for, people who might break their legs or get cancer or something like that? But I wanted to shift to another part of Obama's sort of ambitious agenda that is also, to use the disputed phrase, imperiled, which is cap and trade, the Waxman-Markey bill, which passed in the House but is languishing in the Senate currently. We had a piece on our website by Shika Dalmia about climate change skeptics that you took issue with. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I got the piece, I think it was emailed to me. I guess I'm on a Reason email list. I don't mind Reason banging down my door or banging at my door. I'm happy to get the stuff from
guns.
You. Yeah. And so I read this piece, and it really... maybe I should be talking to Shakia, is that?
Shika.
About it rather than you. But, I got you here. You're an editor at Reason. And so I'll talk to you about it. I tried to nail down what bugged me about this piece. And in order to do that, I kind of wrote out so I'm looking down at a piece of paper now, what the points are in the argument. And so she's got 5 points. First is, basically, there are these people who she calls the echo warriors. I guess that includes 99.9% of the scientific community, but putting that aside, echo warriors used to think that Bush was ruining the planet. But now, it's point two, you look around, you see Obama isn't doing any better. He couldn't get any agreement from recent meeting on this in Europe. He couldn't get anybody to go along with anything other than some, you know, extremely vague words like, let's do something good about this problem. So now Obama supporters of the echo warriors think people are, so what this shows, the fact that Obama couldn't move people on this shows that the human species is crazy. Human species is kind of wired for instant gratification, not capable of thinking long term, because otherwise they would have, you know, snapped to attention when Obama started talking about this issue, when the devil Bush got out of the way. But then she says, really, what's going on is that developing countries, and she focuses particularly on India and China, are choosing quite rationally to deal with current issues of poverty and destitution and potential for mass starvation over worrying about it some distant future. So they've got a choice. You can have, you know, mass starvation now or disaster in the future. So they're rationally choosing to deal with the threats of destitution, poverty, mass starvation now instead of worrying about the distant future. And this is final point. This is a completely rational choice for them to be making because, look, you can deal with future damage when it shows up. That's her argument, as I understand it. And it makes absolutely no sense at all. The reason that it makes no sense at all is because the main argument on the part of the people who study this issue and who are concerned about it, like, as I say, most of the scientific community that works on this question, the argument is that by the time problems get really serious, it's going to be too late to do anything about them. So the argument really is, her argument really is a defense of a kind of short-sightedness. I mean, you know, if you set in motion a bunch of changes that produce irreversible effects, and then you notice that the effects of warming are setting in a very serious way. This is the argument. You notice them in 20 years or 30 years, and they're producing disaster, in particular disaster for marginal populations that are already living in pretty hot places where it's hard to grow stuff. At that point, it's going to be too late to do anything about the problem. So the idea that it's a decision to deal with a problem now and postpone dealing with the problem that might come at some point in the future, deal with it when the problem shows up. This is why I think there's an editorial issue here as well as an issue about the argument. The editorial issue is, if I got this piece as an editor of Boston Review, if I got this piece, I say to the writer, first of all, get rid of the bullshit about the echo warriors. That's jargon and it's not, it's rhetoric and it's not analysis. And the other is you haven't dealt with the main point, which is that a bunch of effects are being set in motion now. And by the time the disaster sets in, it's going to be too late to deal with them. Deal with that now.
A couple of things. I didn't edit that, so I can't really speak from the position of editor. And another is, I mean, you say that she didn't deal with the main point. Well, there are a thousand main points, to paraphrase the 41st president, when it comes to the climate change issue, global warming and stuff. And the point that she was actually trying to make, I think the name of the headline on the piece was White Man's Burden or Global White Man's Burden or something like that. Yeah. And there is a point there, which is that in deliberations about global warming and climate change, there is a tendency among especially sort of European North American activists to point to the two biggest countries that are rapidly industrializing the most, that are going from abject poverty to something quite different, which is one of the greatest changes of our lifetimes.
Absolutely.
And pointing to them and saying, okay, you can't industrialize in the same way, or trying to impose some values. And they are going to get rebuffed by India and China over these, although China is also involved in all kinds of green technology experimentation, as far as I'm aware, which is probably a good deal less than you. And that is an actual interesting point, to say that that it becomes a little bit, it's not going to be convincing when you talk to the former third world or second world or whatever you want to term them and say, you can't go through, you can't make the same mistakes that we did. And I think there's another thing that she didn't maybe explicitly mention, but that undergirds the sort of impulse from which that piece sprang. And it is this. Economic growth is one of the greatest engines in the world for reducing pollution. Among other things, it gives people, consumers, citizens, excess income and comfortability to get mad about political issues like pollution, right? You know, when you're richer, you don't put up with smog nearly as much.
Right.
And not only that, but your companies, you develop the ability to start innovating your way out of that. I mean, the great, we have a great science correspondent, Ron Bailey, who's been covering global warming issues for decades, and he's someone who believes that man is contributing to global warming, and it's something that we should do something about, which is a pretty controversial position among certainly a lot of our readers. And the main question for him, as someone who does believe in human advancement and progress and liberty and economics and stuff like that, and who is concerned about, you know, the Greenland ice shelf getting smaller and some other things, is at what point do your solutions impede that economic growth to the point which that it actually hurts the problem that you're trying to solve? And how much, and conversely, how much of just, you know, putting your hands back and saying, okay, let's let the magic of GDP do this, how much of that is kicking the problem down the road, as you say? That's an adult conversation, and I think it's one that we should all be having. And I think one of the reasons why you see terms such as eco-warriors out there, and you see a lot of frustration expressed from people who come from the side of the aisle that actually wants to talk about those kind of economic issues, is that they are on the minority side of the public debate. I mean, you have sort of routine apocalypticism about this issue, which is... that aspect of it is divorced from science. Not necessarily that everything else is, but there's just sort of a general like background of, you know, it's all going to burn up in 20 years. X you know, event that happened last week proves that there's this, and it can be a frustrating milieu. It doesn't happen to frustrate me, but I can see how it frustrates other people.
Yeah, a couple of things on what you've said, much of which I think is you know, I find pretty agreeable, but there are some maybe focus on and eventually on some points of disagreement. But first thing is I absolutely on the crucial point here about economic growth in China and India. If you just take the Chinese case, you know, people, when people talk about anti-poverty programs in developing countries, they think about, you know, interesting initiatives by NGOs or whatever. But basically, the Chinese economy over the past three decades has been the greatest anti-poverty program in human history. You get about 400 million people out of under a dollar a day poverty. There's nothing comparable to that in the history of the human species. I mean, you know, I'm sure you have, I know I have some disagreements with a bunch of stuff about Chinese politics and political economy. But from the just sheerly from the point of view, let's not talk about the abstraction of economic growth.
Yes.
Let's just talk about taking people who are living at under a dollar a day and moving them out of that destitution. An unbelievable record of success. Secondly, I agree with you that there is a very important issue here. I find it, you know, kind of mind-boggling to think, I mean, this is what people I know talk about all the time, the idea that this is unusual. I find it a little weird, but a huge issue about how you deal with the climate problem, the global warming problem, and also deal with the fact that you know, deal with the global poverty problem. How those two things can be dealt with at the same time, I think, is a very important issue. And I think there ought to be a discussion focused exactly on that. And I think there is a discussion focused on that. I think this piece, and this is what I think got me sort of agitated about, is I completely agree with you. there ought to be a constructive discussion about that. It does not advance a constructive discussion about that topic to say, we'll deal with the climate change problem when it starts doing, serious damage. Because that's not taking the problem seriously. Now, maybe the problem shouldn't be taken seriously, but that's a separate argument. This makes from the point of view of contemporary science, maybe the science is wrong, but from the point of view of where almost all scientists are now, this piece makes a very unconstructive contribution to the discussion by just denying that there are going to be a bunch of irreversible effects set in place that are going to be impossible to deal with by the time they really start causing very, very bad trouble. So I don't know
if there was an explicit denial of that in the piece.
Oh, no, absolutely. Let me just read to you from the piece. If and when climate change promises to claim more casualties than poverty and starvation, the world will begin heeding their calls. I'm going to walk with this telephone because I have to pick up another one.
Okay. Not a good action shot.
Sorry for the equipment failure, but I'm back on now. I'm quoting from the piece, if and when climate change promises to claim more casualties than poverty and starvation, the world will begin heeding their calls. That's the quotation from the last paragraph of the piece. That's not to engage the problem. That's to deny the basic premise of the discussion, which is that by the time those casualties start setting in, it's going to be too late to heed the calls.
I think it does bring up an important point which gets lost in a lot of climate change discussion, and mm-hmm. which is something that I think Johan Norberg has brought up pretty mm-hmm. interestingly, which is that poverty is still, the number one killer out there.
Absolutely.
And that a lot of the focus on some of these issues may have taken the focus away from other important ones. I mean, we should be, we should worry about everything at all times. Of course, that's our job is to worry. For me, I'm thinking of how do we get the next 400 million people out of poverty? And what are the policies that would artificially prevent that from happening? There's some overlap between those two. There's competition between the two impulses that we're talking about here, and that's important to recognize.
Right. There's competition between the impulses, but there's a distinction between saying that there's competition. I agree with you. There's competition between the impulses. What got me worked up about this piece is it denies there's competition. That's exactly the point. It denies there's competition by saying that this other problem can be dealt with when the effects start to materialize. This problem, if the current scientific consensus is right, cannot be dealt with when the problems start to materialize. It's got to be dealt with before then. So there's a serious conversation, and which is, how do you move the next four? There are a billion people in the world, sixth of the world's population, that still lives at under a dollar a day. By the way, half of those people are in India and China. 500 million people living on less than a dollar a day in India and China. So there's a big issue about how you move, about how those people get moved out of poverty. But it's a gross example of short-sightedness to say we can deal with this other problem when the effects start to materialize. I'm concerned about moving the next 400 million people out of poverty. I'm also concerned about being responsible to people who are 20 and 40 and 50 years down the road who are going to suffer for the consequences of our short-sighted decisions. If the current scientific consensus is right, now maybe it's wrong, but I think it's important to have that conversation. And I think one last point on this is you mentioned the fact that, as places get richer, people get more concerned about pollution. I agree about that, absolutely. The problem here is that the global warming problem is not a pollution problem. And the big cause of the global warming problem If people focus on oil, it's really centrally about the use of coal. And that's the biggest producer of greenhouse gases. It's also the engine of economic growth. And so this isn't a pollution issue. And the problem here is that by the time, again, by the time places, countries are rich enough for the population to be really worried about pollution, the coal will have already, if this current scientific consensus is right, the coal will already have done the damage to the climate that's going to make everybody's life miserable, except people who live in really cold places, and maybe you're going to be happier. So you've got it. The big issue here is how do you deal with, coal is the crux of the matter. It's the source of climate change, and it's the engine, the fuel of economic growth. And, I think a strategy, for example, of promoting big investment in a mix of clean coal and carbon capture and storage technology, which is very expensive now. But, what I think environmentalists ought to line up behind is rich countries should be investing a lot in R&D on clean coal and carbon capture and storage technologies, and then transferring the technology free of charge to places that are using lots of coal.
Before we change the subject, which I'm going to do in a second, I'd like to recommend to anyone who's interested in those kind of coal technologies, sequestration technologies, just the questions of R&D in particular. Ron Bailey did a terrific cover story for us in June on this with a skeptical eye about it, because that's what we're here for. But it also has a breakdown of 9 different emerging or promising technologies and what they are, what they involve, what the price points have been, are, and will be in the future. And I think it really contributes to the discussion in a materially useful way.
Let me second that recommendation. It's a very good piece. And just add one important point of agreement here, which is that anybody who says that this is our salvation now is full of shit. because... this stuff, it's very expensive, it's very early in the game, it's a direction that you could think about going if you're looking to reconcile a sensible concern about future generations with a sensible concern about contemporary economic growth that will continue to pull a bunch of people out of poverty and destitution.
So enough trashing my colleagues, let's start trashing yours.
Yeah.
Condoleezza Rice is back at Stanford, where she was once the provost. I've never really understood what the word provost means. But she came back. It was controversial. There was a petition, and I'm not exactly sure what the petition said. Was it to block her or just to protest her coming back or whatever? You were there. I believe that you signed the petition or you were involved in some way. Can you lay out the controversy and the case against having a former Secretary of State come back to her academic roost?
Yeah. So Condoleezza Rice is a colleague of mine in the political science department. Her picture is on the, faculty board outside the office. She's also a fellow at the Hoover Institution. She returned. It's a very unusual case. Academics usually don't get 8 years of leave to go and do a different job. Henry Kissinger didn't get it from Harvard. Places sometimes go to 3 or 4 years. So it's very unusual for an academic institution to say, take your time, come back whenever you want. And that's in effect what Stanford did. So Secretary Rice returned to the campus probably around January 21st, more or less, after her job in Washington ended. And there actually, I think, has been, in some way surprisingly little agitation about the issue. I certainly didn't sign anything or support anything that said that she shouldn't be permitted to return to Stanford. I think she should be prosecuted for torture, but that's a different issue.
Was that the issue then that people were talking about? It was
people were mixing a whole bunch of different issues. There were some, there's a, Rice in the first Bush term was the National Security Advisor. She was the head of the Principals Committee, which was a very important player in, you know, very close to the ground decisions about enhanced interrogation techniques, aka decisions about whether or not to use what are generally recognized as methods of torture against people. And I fully expect that there are going to be there already are some legal actions that have been set in motion against people who are involved in those decisions. I don't know where Holder is going to come out on this, although I think that there ought to be some kind of some effort at legal remedy. Whether she's guilty or not, I don't know. I don't know the law in the area well enough, but I think there's a reasonable case for moving forward with a discussion about that. But you know, basically the deal at Stanford is Stanford's rules say that you can't, the provost, that's the chief academic officer, the provost can't initiate an action against any member of the faculty unless the member of the faculty has done something while they are in connection with their job as a professor, more or less. I don't remember exactly what the word is. So if you're, it's different from rules that you have at other places, for example, MIT and Berkeley, where if you get arrested, if you get, say, convicted of murdering somebody, you can be sanctioned as a member of the faculty. I guess you could probably lose your job. At Stanford, you can only get in trouble for doing something that you did as a professor. So if you rape somebody on the street, you can't get in trouble. If you sexually harass a student in your office, then you can get in trouble. Uh-huh. Whether this is a way of, a kind of rule that makes sense, I don't want to get into that question, but it is the rule that's in place, and I think, ex post fact, changing the rules after the fact isn't the right thing to do. But in any case, I think the big issue is not whether now Professor Rice is at Stanford or not. I think the big issue is the issue about whether or not there's a stand taken that people who are involved in torture as decision makers, in particular as decision makers, are held to legal account for it. And I think they ought to be held to legal account for it.
You will get no argument from me on that. I think that the U.S. torturing is something that I never really thought would be a public discussion in my lifetime, and I think it's a stain on our national conscience. And I'm also generally in favor of prosecuting all politicians whenever possible.
Well, I don't share.
lose in that. At the same time, have a good time teaching at Stanford. I find Condoleezza Rice just sort of on a meta level or detached level, a pretty interesting character and figure, and just the whole kind of, you're someone who looks at foreign policy. I mean, she emerged from the kind of Madeleine Albright's father, who's a giant in the field of foreign policy studies in this country, Joseph Korbel, who's from Czechoslovakia. He was a diplomat who then went and taught, I think, at the University of Colorado at Boulder or Denver at Boulder
or
something.
University of Denver.
She came from there. Madeleine Albright also came from there, and it's a very interesting tendency. She was kind of a Sovietologist with an interest in Central European themes, which is pretty common among modern diplomats. Less so, actually, maybe in the Obama administration, and that might actually be a decent segue to talk about that. There was a recent, I don't know if you saw this, but a bunch of 1989 dissidents from the sort of Václav Havel, Lech Walesa, Pavel Demish, a lot of Slovaks, interestingly enough, signed this kind of open letter in the grand Middle European tradition to Barack Obama, warning about realism, the return of realism in American foreign policy, especially vis-a-vis Russia. They were kind of worried that they were once again going to have their interests sort of sold down the river in the names of having better superpower relations. I found it fascinating on a variety of levels. I mean, on one sense, it was it's kind of an expression of lament or anguish that their generation is now really sort of receding into the sunset, and that and the massive influence that they had on American foreign policy in the 90s and aughts, which really cannot be overstated, I think, is waning. And so part of this is just sort of an expression of that. But it also brings to question some ideas about Obama's own sense of realism. There was a piece in the New York Times earlier this week about a country who I will never try to pronounce, Kyrgyzstan. Whatever, it's too complicated. I just say Turk Shittistan and kind of go from there. But anyways, it's a lousy
country. Come on.
I lived around there. I can make a joke with my friends.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, I can get it as wrong as you. So.
That's pretty good. Uzbekistan's more phonetic. Anyways, yeah. Kyrgyzstan is a basket case. Its leader is a dictator. He generally beats up opposition members and whatever, but also houses a U.S. military base. And in the Obama presidency, which is and foreign policy, which is sort of doubling down on or expanding U.S. military operations in Central Asia, it becomes more important to play nice with people who border the countries that you are meddling in. And it's an expression of Obama's realism, one that involves, you know, kind of looking the other way and sending nice letters of thank you and support to nasty people who are sort of antithetical to American kind of values. And I was just wondering, as someone who takes a lot of interest in American foreign policy and sort of human rights worldwide, what's your kind of take or assessment on at least that kind of expression of Obamian realism?
You know, I think I'm not exactly, I don't feel completely comfortable with framing these discussions. There's realism, and then there's this other thing, which is the Wilsonian, you know, idealist impulse. And the, you know, the problem in the Bush administration was, I guess, that there was supposed to be an excess of the Wilsonian idealist impulse, and maybe that was what led to the torture policy, was an excess of Wilsonian idealist. I mean, I don't, like the idea that the, generally don't like the idea of American unilateralism in foreign policy. I think the United States, you know, it's a, you know, an important, obviously the, an important, the most, maybe the most important player in international relations and security issues in particular, but I think the idea that the United States should be the unilateral principal defender of human rights in the world is, you know, misguided both as a description of fact and also misguided as a guide to as a guide to policy. The right way to you know, uphold human rights is through unilateral American decision. That's why, for example, what some people have seen as excessive caution on Obama's side in the Iran, you know, green revolution, green protest beginning on June 12th, I thought was exactly right. I wish Obama had been as reticent to get into the conflict between Skip Gates and Sergeant Crowley in Cambridge as he was. I think he kind of, you know, maybe he should have dipped his toe in that water, and instead he jumped into the river with both feet. And I think in an unwise way. But we did promise a Gates-free zone, so I'm going to stop talking about the Gates affair. But I think in the Iran case, a kind of the right attitude was you know, an attitude of caution. And I think there were two reasons for that. First, there is a huge amount of understandable suspicion, a huge amount of understandable suspicion directed toward the United States because of the historical role of the United States in Iran and the overthrow of Mossadegh in 53, 54, but also in the role that the United States played in the Iran-Iraq war. So, but it's not only that. It's also that maybe Obama understands anyway, I hope, you know, that the principal force that will, you know, build a democracy and a lasting democracy in Iran are the people in Iran. The United States doesn't really have the levers to, you know, to make that happen. And you can do a lot of things to make things worse. So there was a kind of, you know, what Lincoln described as, you know, patient confidence in the ultimate justice of the people, talking about the United States and the slavery issue. But I thought maybe there was evidence of a kind of patient, I think entirely appropriate in the Iran case, and patient confidence in the ultimate justice of people in Iran, and that they were the principal agents of the you know, destiny of the country. And I think an excess of a kind of American moralizing, leading to an excess of intervention, leading to making a mess of the place as if it were principally our responsibility as opposed to the responsibility of people in Iran, which they're taking on. I think it was the right thing, exactly the right attitude to have.
I'm in a broad agreement or general agreement about the approach to Iran. I would be maybe more confident or happy if I felt like he would take a similar approach to the rest of the world, and I'm just not convinced that that's going to happen, especially in Central Asia, but not only. You know, the temptations are just too built in. The incentives are just too built in. Whatever you decide as a president of the United States is a pressing issue. You know, you look around and you can exert your will much more strongly in foreign policy than you can in domestic policy. And there will be places that, you know, that outrage your sense of values, and you're going to pull the lever. The lever is sitting at your desk. And I think one thing I followed a lot when I was covering the Democratic Convention in Denver was all the different strains of discussion talking about foreign policy. And I was very interested to note that the person who was kind of front and center of all of that discussion was Madeleine Albright. You know, about a Wilsonian. She's a Wilsonian on steroids. She's very much America is the indispensable nation. She was the architect or one of the architects of the war in Kosovo, which had a lot less sort of legal support than the war in Iraq, among other things. And I should point confess to, you know, I am kind of a Wilsonian who was mugged by the Iraq war or something like that. I shared her worldview to a much greater degree back then than I do now. But I was surprised that a president who campaigned or first got his first, like, real great oxygen as the anti-war candidate, everything else about his speechcraft and the people who were talking and leading discussions was much more kind of aggressive America as the indispensable nation type of thing. And I see it as, in a regrettably kind of cynical way, as a kind of inevitable expression of what the power relations are out there. It was interesting. And I wrote about it for us that, you know, the Iran thing made me glad that McCain wasn't president because he looks for, you know, any opportunity to kind of pull a brinksmanship type of confrontation with any rogue state. I mean, he authored the idea of rogue state rollback, which is an incredibly radical interventionist notion. I think an essential problem in global relations and American foreign policy is just that we have this, you know, we take a disproportionate share of responsibility for the world's affairs. This makes the target on our back bigger, and it makes other countries less prone to develop and take their own responsibility for their own affairs, which is the messy way in which they will become more responsible and better actors. So I think the jury is way still out on Obama, and I think he's been inconsistent in his approach. I don't think that you could say that he took the same approach in Honduras that he did with Iran, and it's kind of difficult to, on a daily basis, to track exactly where he is. But I do agree that his stressing during the protests in Iran that this isn't about America was that itself was not just accurate but the right point to make.
Let me just say one last point on this, which is I say those things about Iran as a very strong supporter of the Iranian, democratic movement, a strong supporter of the hunger strike that is taking place right now at the United Nations with participation by Akbar Ganji, among others. And by the way, I should mention, I had the conversation with people who were there yesterday. Noam Chomsky was there yesterday as a strong supporter of the, I know, Noam gets a lot of bad press in a lot of places and pretty good press in other places. And the people who were there on a three-day hunger strike at the UN were apparently very, very grateful for his showing up for that. So I'm a strong supporter of the Iranian democratic movement, and I think the best way for the American government to support the Iranian democratic movement is to have some confidence in the decency, integrity, intelligence, political capacity of people in Iran, and to recognize that this is going to take a very long time to work itself out, just as our own democratic process took a very long time to work itself out, and there's going to be a lot of ugly stuff that happens in the meantime. But I think yielding to this impulse to think that we're not only, the indispensable player, but the doer of all that's good, is something that ought to be resisted. And on that happy note of agreement between you and me, I think maybe we should bring it around.
Yeah, that's great. This has been fun.
Good, good to talk, Matt.
Hope to do this in the future, and have a good haircut.
I'll see you. Yeah, I'm about to go to the barber, and as people who are watching this can see, I don't really. It's going to be a very short visit to the barber.
It's a social.
But anyway, I'll see you on Facebook.
Okay.
All right. Bye bye.